Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts.
Hello, everyone. Today, we are here on the Ivy Podcast with our next guest, Cesar Pesce. Cesar, thank you so much for joining our podcast today and taking your time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's really my pleasure.
Cesar, so please tell us more about yourself. Tell us more about your background.
Yeah, so I was born in Rome, in Italy. I'm French Italian. I'm French on my mom's side, Italian on my dad's side. I lived in Japan, Tokyo, then in Milan. Now I'm living in Denmark, Copenhagen. Also spent some time in Bournemouth in the United Kingdom. I worked pretty much like I did sales in a Danish scallop. It was called Clerk.io. I can tell you later if you want a bit more. I did sustainable finance, where I'm also I wouldn't say an activist, but I'm in a club that's called the CBS Sustainable Finance Club at the Copenhagen Business School, where I'm finishing my master. And I also worked in investment banking. Before that, I also did some SEO, so search engine optimization, content marketing. And now I'm with YXS Capital, and it's a venture capital. Basically, it's based in Miami, I can tell you more of it also a bit later on YXS Capital, what we do. But it's a very nice story. We're actually building the fund right now. The narrative behind it, it's really, really cool. I'm also regarding the education. Well, I graduated I finished high school. I did economics because of the French system. You used to have the option between either like the scientific route, where you do maths and science, the economic route, where you do maths and economics and also a bit of history, and then you have the language route. I chose the economics one. So I graduated there, and then I did a bachelor in international business, which is the most prestigious business-related bachelor in Scandinavia, here at CBS, also at the Copenhagen Business School, where I'm minoring in finance, and now I'm minoring in risk management, and finishing my master in June.
Wow, that's a great background, Cesar. Congratulations on achieving so many things at such a young age, because I'm myself a very young VC who also got into venture capital at the age of 24. And, according to your background and according to everything that you say, I'm sure that you achieved it at a relatively young age. Yeah. So congratulations on that. I do realize how hard it is, right, to actually be in the venture capital ecosystem, because the majority of VCs and the majority of investors are the people who have already achieved a lot of things in their personal lives, right? Whether it be selling their own businesses or making a couple of successful exits or just starting a VC firm after finishing their successful careers. So I totally understand that. And by the way, regarding your education, which is also so highly valuable, and it's also so broad, because you've studied in so many countries, mostly European, that must have gave you a lot of not only knowledge but also expertise and also network with which you are able to operate in your professional career. So congratulations on that.
Thanks, I highly appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so you've lived and studied in Italy, right? Italy, France, UK, Japan, yeah. Denmark. What first drew you toward finance and venture capital?
Yeah, so as you say, I was in Tokyo, in Japan, then back to Rome. So Rome, Japan, Rome, Milan, Japan, back to Rome, then Copenhagen, and also some time in the UK. Let's go back a bit in time. I also want to give you a very fun short story. Basically, before I wanted to do politics, and I say want to do politics actually, but before I wanted to do politics, at 8, how the teacher asks you, it's like, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? And most people say, I want to be a firefighter, a policeman, a dancer, whatever it is. And I say, well, I want to be the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And the teacher looked at me like I was some crazy dude, and you know, she was like, okay, this guy's a bit weird. I'm wondering what his family is telling him. And I really liked politics from early on, like from the age 7, 8, 9, I started follow Italian politics. But then, you know, around, and I wanted to have a career within politics. But then around 15 and 16, I realized that having your whole career around politics is actually wrong, because your incentives are not, you know, centered around the people incentives. People, now, since your income depends on your career, you say what people want you here. You don't really say what's best for them, right? It's because you want to get elected your whole life, basically. That's how it works. And I thought it was morally wrong. I thought, well, I don't want to do politics because I want to get voted my whole life. I want to re-express my ideals and my opinions. And then if people like me, it's good. If they don't like me, I can leave. So having a whole career centered around it, I think it's wrong. So I said, you know what? I still want to do it, but I need to find something else. And then when I finish that something else, I can then go into politics. And as I told you before, I did economics at school. I really liked it. So I did microeconomics, you know, macroeconomics. And the first time I heard about investment was when we talked about Bitcoin. At the time, Bitcoin was, I think, at $3,000. So it would have been an amazing time to buy. I think now it's like 117, 116. And that's the first time when I heard about investments. And I was like, okay, you know what? I like it. And then when I first made, you know, when I made my first real money at 18, I bought, my first investment was a token was called Loopring. And I put 100 Danish kroner in it, which is like $14, so really not much. And after a week, I doubled the money. And I was like, I immediately sold. And I thought, wow, I love this. You know, you don't do anything and your money goes up and can, of course, can go down. And a month after, actually also found, so a month after I checked and the token at 19x. So I actually regretted selling. I could have made so much more money. I mean, so much more. It was like 100 kroner, so it's not that much. But I thought, you know what? I really, really like it. I want to make a career around it. And that's where I started to dig into finance and to see, okay, the different options. So, okay, so you have investment banking, you have private equity, you have venture capital. And then I said, well, you know what? Venture capital seems very, very interesting because you have this side of course, you have finance, but then you also have the people side, the innovation side. And I really think that, you know, we live in a world where now innovation is more important than ever. And we need to finance that. We need people that take the risk to finance that. And most often than not, actually, it doesn't work more often than not. But when it works really well. And I thought, you know what, we need that because without innovation, we're going backwards. And I thought, you know what, that's what I want to do. And that's how I jumped into venture capital.
Wow, that's such a beautiful story because, you know, when I was studying back at the university, so I was studying at the Geneva Business School in Europe as well. So oh, I was so passionate about. Yeah, I used nice. To study in Barcelona for mm-hmm. years. So there was a business school called Geneva Business School. So they yeah. had a branch yeah. in Barcelona. So I studied there for 3 years. And actually, my major was a Bachelor of Business Administration with major in international relations. So yeah. At the time, like, you know, 7, 8 years ago, I was so passionate about politics. I was so passionate about, you know, the next minister of foreign affairs of Kazakhstan. And it gave me so much inspiration because I was just imagining myself how I'm going to, you know, go, you know, walk in a nice suit, just go and meet people, handshakes, you know, and prestigious job, you know, and stuff like that. So I can relate to you 100% here. We actually have a lot of things in common, like, you know, in terms of getting into venture capital very early, in terms of studying the same things at the university, at the college. So everything that you're telling me right now, I'm feeling so, you know, so connected because I can totally relate to everything that you're saying. So that's a very beautiful story.
Are you still, are you still like me hoping one day to get back into it? Or you're like, no, I really want to get over it into politics and really get into the venture capital, never back into politics?
Well, that's a very good question because, you know, occasionally I'm actually sitting in an office or whenever I go out for a walk, all the time I think about, you know, just being out there, you know, not only just working for myself, but also maybe being out there and meeting some, you know, important people, meeting some people who actually make change and, you know, deliver something important to the world. And I've been always, you know, dreaming about talking to these kind of people so that we come up with something important together. So we, you know, solve the world kind of world issues together. So that, you know, I'm out there and on the TV, you know, giving interviews to some people, maybe also being a host who interviews industry experts, just like I'm doing right now. So I think partially everything I've dreamt of already came true. But also at the same time in the future, I'm also considering maybe one day if an opportunity to become the next Minister of Foreign Affairs of Kazakhstan pops up, definitely I'm going to take that opportunity because I think that's like a, maybe like a teenage dream that I might, you know, consider like doing, right, in the maybe like in the next 10, 15 years. So we never know.
I agree.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. What about what were your very first steps into the VC world? So you told me that once you know once you graduated from a university, you started being you know showing some interest in buying the Bitcoins in the investment world. So after that, what were your first you know VC steps?
Yeah, so actually I got in very randomly. I was working at the time for a Danish scale-up, clerk.io, that his name still exists. I was in the sales department in the entire market. And it was we were doing $10 million in ARR, then we went to $12 million in ARR. I left. And then I received a phone call. Actually, no, I received a LinkedIn message from someone that was working at UOB Ventures. He messaged me and said, because at the time UOB Ventures was both a VC, but they were also having, and it still exists actually to this day. And we're also having an advising section, you know, for founders, giving them advice like consulting. And he told me, look, we know this company. They are looking for funding. Would you be interested in being an investor? Because I also make some small investments, as I told you on the side. But I told him, look, I can't put like 50K in a startup. And we had a call on WhatsApp and he really liked me, we really liked each other. And he told me, you know what? I really want to introduce you to UTS, who is the managing partner. And I had a call with UTS and really liked each other. And that's how I jumped really into the venture capital, to the venture capital world. So I joined as an analyst, before part-time, then almost full-time, like a three quarter time, like a bit more than a part-time or less than a full-time. Then I go to be an associate, really working alongside UTS. And now we, as I said before, we've just launched YXS Capital, which is basically a following of UOB Ventures, investing from, just to give you know, some short context, the VC is based in Miami. We invest from a Series A to Series C in companies so we have like five core sectors. So we have the financial technology, we have dual use. So it's like both military, you know, civilian space tech, robotics and manufacturing, AI and automation workflow, and energy infrastructure. So clean energy. And these are the five core sectors. And we invest most in the US, but we also invest in Europe and UK and the Middle East. And we also open to Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's definitely amazing because, you know, there are a lot of maybe young people who are graduating from universities every year, and they're always thinking about, you know, becoming successful quick, I guess. Yeah. So I would say, what advice would you give to those fresh graduates, right, who just graduated from a university, yeah, that looking their own path in life? And, you know, because your personal story is so inspiring, you know, turning from a student who studied economics and then, you know, switching to venture capital. A lot of people are just dreaming about this kind of career. And in your personal opinion, what would you, you know, advise? What would your one advice be to fresh graduates who wants to start their career at the venture capital?
First of all, don't do it for the money, because actually, if you're really good, you're going to end up in venture capital. So that means you can also end up in private equity, in investment banking. So if you're fresh out of uni, if you're doing for the money, don't do it, because as an analyst, you're going to get more money in investment banking, private equity, and you know it as well. And also later in your career as a partner, where VCs make money is when they exit, right? When they exit, and that's where, you know, when the carry comes in, that's where the partners really make a lot of money. It's on the salary. So if on average, you know, someone in investment banking is going to make more money than someone in VC, the top people in VC, they're going to make a tremendous amount of money. But these are the top people. So unless you are one of them, you're not going to get there. So that's the first thing. So if you do it for the money, sure, you're going to make good money. But investment banking is better for you. So that's the first thing. Second is, like, don't chase it. Because I didn't chase it. It just came to me. And I think that if you do things well, opportunities are going to come to you. And then it's really up to you. And you have to develop this instinct to being able to really seeing the opportunities. Because the opportunity doesn't mean that, like, you know, someone's going to ring at your door and be like, hey, you know, I have this open position for you. That's not how it works. But you need to, like, to look for it, and you need to, like, see the opportunities coming. And when you see the right opportunities, just jump on board. But again, it's really depending on what you think is right for you at the moment, because you might think, oh, I want to do this, I want to do this, I want to do this. But you might need to develop other skills before that are going to be really helpful. For instance, working a startup before, you know, working in private equity, I think helps, because you really get to see a bit how it works, instead of immediately jumping to venture capital. And then finally, you know, I would say, just if you think it's the right way for you, go for it. But always remember that it's important to develop other skills first.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with you, because, you know, the majority of young people, actually, they're always chasing some shiny objects, I would say, because I'd be one of them a couple of years ago. You know, not being patient, always want to get something very fast, because I used to, you know, punish myself in the past that it looked like I hustled a lot, I worked a lot, and I wanted to get everything right now. So yeah, I totally agree with you. And I would also maybe suggest young people who are just graduating from university really understand whether or not VC's career is going to be the perfect fit for you, because it's a long game, right? It's a long-term commitment that you have to take and that you have to consider for your future career. Because even though VCs do get successful most of the times, but it gets, you know, it takes you at least 5 years to get somewhere, right? To at least make something. So it's a long-term game, and patience here is absolutely, like, fundamental. You should have that patience. You should have that perseverance to really, you know, commit to the time that that's going to take for you to at least get somewhere.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, you know, basically, obviously, everyone got VC capital from different backgrounds, from, you know, different industries. And obviously, it's amazing when you have a mentor, right? Or somebody who always guides you, somebody who always helps you to find your right path, right? Did you have a mentor on your path to, you know, to becoming a great VC? If so, what role that mentor played in your VC career?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that the mentor actually, and that's also related to the previous question, is some people ask me, you know, why working in VC? I'm like, you should find someone that you like working with. And that's also very important, because we take it for granted. But when you work with someone that you really like to work with, be really careful about like leaving, because it's really not for granted that you're gonna find someone else, like the person. And I know it very well. So in this case, you know, the managing partner of UB Ventures and now also managing partner of Access Capital, UTIS Tunelier, who's based in Miami. It was, I would say, my mentor, like not before joining the UB Ventures, but after joining, you know, it really helped me grow. He told me, look, from the beginning, it's like, treat this as your company. So be like an entrepreneur and really like, tell me your ideas. You're going to fail sometimes. Sometimes you're going to propose things. It's going to be totally, you know, BS, totally bullshit. Pardon my French. But he told me, look, you have to try. And I will welcome, you know, anything you propose, but try things. And of course I tried, some things worked, some things didn't work. But he really trusted me and I really, really appreciate that. I grew a lot under him and I'm still growing under him. I work really well with him. So that's really, 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 really great. I love working with him. Speaking French, he's from Belgium originally, from Charleroi. So we speak in French. He's now been in Miami for 11 years. So he's more American than Belgian, but he's a really, really nice guy. And yeah, that's the reason also why I stayed in UB Ventures. Because when you find people like these that really help you, that really trust you, you follow them. Because honestly, it's not granted at all that you're going to find someone like these people. And yeah, so, and something I, you know, he also did at the beginning was like every time he had a call, he would invite me on the call. So I would see how he speaks, you know, how he speaks to founder, how he does it, what are the techniques, what are the questions to ask, what are the questions not to ask. So really, really like live mentoring. And then I was, you know, from this, I would then go on my side and do the rest. But I definitely learned a lot and still learning a lot from him.
Wow, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing. Because the reason I asked this question is because I have a mentor of my own myself. So the co-host of this podcast is Jan. He's mine. You know, to be honest, he actually made such a huge impact on my life. Yeah. That's the person who actually taught me a lot of things about VC. And I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be interviewing such experienced, you know, industry experts if it wasn't for him. So I just want to take this time to, you know, maybe say a huge thank you to my mentor who actually taught me almost everything he knows about VC, almost everything he knows about, you know, how to structure deals, how to do the term sheets, how to conduct podcasts, how to negotiate terms, right, and stuff like that. A lot of things I've learned from him. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think without a good mentor to whom you can look up to, and from whom you can really learn on a daily basis, I think a career in a VC would get really tough. Because I know that, you know, being a VC is almost like being a startup founder. Because it gets sometimes very lonely, it gets tough, it gets difficult, sometimes you lose, right? And it gets you overwhelmed. And without that guidance, without that person who actually knows what you're going through, it's actually, it's going to get very tough. Yeah. So yeah, having a good mentor is absolutely key in our industry.
Yeah, and I also want to say, you know, related to this question, maybe not really a mentor, but someone who's also really helping at the moment is the other managing partner of Access Capital, Sonny Patel, who I met for the first time in May, but was known UTIS for several years now. And he also, he, I wouldn't say again, not a mentor, but he still really helps me. You know, he gives me advice, you know, and since he has a completely different style compared to UTIS, because UTIS is more like, you know, his background is like he was more like a founder. He worked in finance as well, but more like a founder. So he has this type of background. He has a certain style. Sonny, on the other hand, is like deep in finance, you know, investment banking, M&A. And then he also built, you know, a software on his own. But he also has, he really has this finance, this deep finance background, and they have two complete different styles. Like Sonny's like, do this, do this, do this, do this. Yotis is much more like, he calls me and he's like, yeah, you know, do this. But it's much, much more different. And so when you have these two styles, you get used to it. Of course, at the beginning, it's like a bit of shock because you're used to one. So when you have something else, you need to juggle a bit. But it's actually really helpful because then when you combine both styles, you get like, it's almost like a hybrid, you know, like it's a superpower. So yeah, I also want to say that too, that Sonia as well is really helping me a lot. And, you know, having these two styles, being able to combine that, it's definitely something that's doing good to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing. Because we have two partners, two GPs in our fund, and two of them are completely different in terms of their characters.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with you on this term. Because, you know, if a person is totally identical to his partner, right, it's going to get so, you know, difficult because they think the same way, they act the same way, and obviously they will be having a lot of conflicts of interest. So, yeah, I totally agree with you in terms of partners being different because that's when they actually, they're able to build something truly valuable because they know each other, they see each other, and they know how to compensate on each other's weaknesses.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely.
Right. I just wanted to quickly transition perhaps to the differences between the American VC industry and also Northern European. So you've worked with US-based firms while living in Denmark. How would you compare VC culture in Northern Europe with the US?
Well, that's also a really good question. So the US VC culture is much different. You know, Danish VCs, for instance, are very... they have a different style. Also, the offices are different. For instance, I was on, it was last week, I was at the Dreamcraft office. They were, you know, Dreamcraft is a pretty well-known, you know, VC here in Copenhagen. I think it's a 70 million euro fund. So pretty big. That's like, what, $80 million, $85 million. And they're quite broad, you know, generalist. And they were hosting an event, you know, about AI and gaming. And in the offices, they had like a baby food, like a beer yard. They had a very big office for like, what, five people. On our side, you know, our Access Capital, we're much more lean. So it's two different styles. Also, the startups are very different. And again, also the VCs, the American VCs, they deploy much more capital and they're much more risk-taking. The risk-takers, they take a lot more risk. The Danish ones, but that's also more broadly the European ones. There are a lot of reasons. It's not that the European ones are more stupid or whatever. It's just that they're because of regulations, because of the culture, like they're much more risk averse. So they deploy smaller checks. They need to see bigger numbers, bigger results. It's a bit different. So the risk side is also different. And then the startups simply are different. For instance, if you take like a Danish, and here I'm jumping a bit on the internalization, but if you take, for instance, a Danish Danish founder from the beginning, if he wants or she wants to become a unicorn, that person will have to go international because Denmark has a population of 6 million people. They actually passed the 6 million bar 2 months ago, 3 months ago. They have a small population. That's like, I think a fourth of the population of New York, just to give you an idea of the whole country. So of course you have to go international, and that's a strength that the Nordic founders have, but also the European founders have, because then they will go to the US, that they have to think international from the beginning, while the American ones, they don't necessarily need that, because even if you stay within the US, you can become like such a big company, a deca unicorn, and you know, be worth, you know, a lot of billion dollars. This is not the case for the European ones, so they have to really think strategically from the beginning, think about internalization, and that's an advantage that they have over the American ones, is that they're much more used to think and, you know, being in a situation where they're not in their comfort zone, and that's definitely something that they have that the American ones don't necessarily have. And then also the landscape is different. For instance, the Nordic VCs, they invest a lot in green energy. and they basically invest a lot where the big companies are. For instance, you have Ørsted, you know, big Danish company, energy company. They invest a lot in energy. You have Novo Nordisk, you know, pharmaceuticals. They invest a lot in pharmaceutical and biotechnology. You have Maersk shipping. They invest a lot in shipping, you know, softwares and this type of services. Sweden, that's for Denmark. Sweden, for instance, is a bit different. Like, you know, you have Spotify, Klarna. So Sweden is a bit different. They're much more like tech-oriented, AI-oriented. Then you have Norway, but in Norway you don't have much going because they have the oil. They're so rich. They actually don't need it. There was actually, I think, an article by Bloomberg a couple of months ago, you know, as they were, I didn't read the article, but they were saying the title was, "Is Norway Too Rich?" Like, they reached a point where, you know, they don't really need to work. So the landscape is very different across the three countries. Then you have Iceland, but I mean, Iceland is so small. But you also have some activity in Iceland, though. I saw a startup in Iceland was doing music, so like a different Spotify with AI. I forgot exactly what it was. I talked to the founder 6 months ago, 7 months ago. So the landscape is different. And now in Europe, we're seeing a lot of defense techs because of the war in Ukraine, which is something that we didn't see before. And yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing, because I totally agree with you. I also wanted to add, you know, the cultural thing in terms of, so for example, when I meet US investors, I notice the speed and appetite for, whereas when I meet like European investors, European VCs, I sense more relationship building and that they are more focused on building a relationship. Do you think it's true? Do you agree with that statement?
I totally do. Yeah, they're much, much faster. The American ones, the European ones, they tend to really take their time. And again, there are multiple reasons. It's not because the Americans are clever and the Europeans are stupid. It's culture, it's the regulation, it's a multiple factors that, and it's also the number of VCs, the number of capital, the LPs backing these VCs, because there is also that side of VCs that founders, you know, don't really consider, but in a way, we are startups ourselves. Like, we also have investors, you know, behind us. And these fund of funds, so the funds investing in the VCs also have people behind it. So it never ends. So in the end, you know, we all have to be very careful. But the regulation behind it is so different. So it's not a question of, like, who's more clever, who's more stupid. But it's true. Yeah, Americans are faster and more risk takers, while Europeans, they tend to be quite the opposite. But that's changing. I have to say that after COVID is changing, there have been also like a lot of, you know, criticism in Europe, like lots of jokes on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I think you saw the memes or like, oh, the Japanese invented this, the Chinese invented this, Americans. Then you have Europeans, you have the, you know, the bottle. The fact that you have the top that, you know, can't be removed. And it was, of course, a bad joke on Europe. But Europe is waking up a bit, especially in defense. I don't think they're never going to catch up, of course, to the US, but they're, you know, getting more and more closer. But there is also the whole, you know, environment in general. Like, in Europe, you have a different environment, like the middle class in Europe. Like, because then you have to go to the core center of things and being like, what incentives do you have to be a founder in the US, and what incentives do you have in Europe? And in Europe, you have less incentives because, like, you have lots of things for free, you know, the state, you know, you have a big welfare. Actually, if you take a salary, you live a good life, you have much more securities, the schools are free. In most countries, universities are almost free. And that's not the case in the US. So you also have this different side of the culture that's totally different. So if you're in the middle class in Europe, you live much better than in the US. So why you should take a risk on being a founder, right?
Yes.
So it's different.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing. I also wanted to, you know, transition quickly to maybe trends and investment styles, because soon enough, we're also hosting our next online startup pitch competition. Okay. And I'm sure there are a lot of startup founders who who are going to listen to this episode in the future. And I wanted to ask, maybe, so you've helped raise more than $70 million, according to your LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And what would be one key thing founders often overlook when pitching investors, in your personal opinion?
Only one?
Well, let's say from one to three.
Yeah, I mean, you have lots of them. First of all, you know, speaking to the wrong founders, to the wrong, investors. I know it sounds very basic, but you have many, many startups, many founders that reach out to everybody. Let's say you are a prop tech US company. They reach out to Australian, you know, food tech VCs, thinking, well, I'm going to try my best shot. You know, I'm going to reach out to everybody. My first advice, of course, is don't do that. It's going to look bad on you first. It's going to look like you didn't do your homework, like you're lazy and like you're desperate for capital. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I see a lot of them also saying, oh, our round is going to close. So you need to make a move fast. So you have the first call and everything goes well. And then, of course, you take your time, right? It always takes like a month or two. Because we need to discuss internally, you know, maybe generate a memo, go to the investment committee. It takes time. I think a second call, a third call, a fourth call, you know, if we're really interested and it's a big investment or talking to customers. Something they do or they like, they say, oh, yeah, you know what? Our round is closing soon. We have to, if you wanna get in, it's getting oversubscribed. You have to reply to me in 5 days. Otherwise, you know, it's over. And for me, that's quite personal, to be fair, but to me, that's like quite a big red flag. And I hate when they do that, because it really, that's something that I was doing when I was in sales, you know, saying, hey, you know, we have a big discount, a big Black Friday, but hey, the discount is finishing on Friday. And actually the discount will go on for 4 months, and they do exactly the same. And I really don't like it, because, to me, that shows that you don't really understand how it works. I'm still in the due diligence. If you tell me if I don't do it by Friday, you think I'm going to get in, you're completely wrong. It's going to still take me time. Like, it's going to still take me like another month or two. And actually when they say that put me off a bit. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing, they don't understand really the involvement behind it. Like, having a VC on board is not just like having investors. It's not an angel. VCs take lots of equity. They have preferred rounds. They have, you know, a board seat most of the time. You know, depends on the stage, depending on the VC. And it's almost like, I know you heard it already, but it's like a marriage. You know, it's probably going to last, you know, between 8 to 12 years. You really need to like each other. It's not really like having an investor investing money and being sitting there. It's not like when you're investing in stocks. You know, the VCs are active. You need to be, you know, to be ready to have them call you and be like, where is my money? How is it going? You know, how are you growing? Can I see your numbers? And then you're going to have also the service providers of the VC reaching out to the startups, you know, being like, what's your numbers? Because then for compliance, for, you know, when you do, when the audit is done every year, you need to, all the taxes are done as well. You need to have these kind of numbers ready. So that's a whole type of relationship that goes on. It's not just like the money comes in and see you in 10 years. And they don't understand it. Most of them don't understand it. They really like are so desperate for the capital. They don't really see that side. But even when they get the capital, then they start to be like, okay, maybe I shouldn't have done the way I did it, because the involvement is really there. Then some of them simply should not be pitching to VCs, because either it's too early or they actually don't need it. Because again, that's linked to what I said before, but the way I see it, and I know maybe I shouldn't say that as a VC, is really pitch to VCs at the last moment, because they're going to take so much from you that, you know, you want to make sure that it's the latest possible. And there have been so many studies saying that, like, a company, you know, companies that have $10 million in a recurring revenue, so like roughly $100 million valuation, when they exit, you know, and these VC-backed companies, when they exit, they actually have less than someone that maybe exit at, you know, 5-10, you know, less valuation, so like $20 million valuation, because the VCs take so much. It's not just like the percentage, you know, of what they have. It's also like the preferred rounds, you know, the liquidation preferences. And these are all things that usually they don't consider, which to me is, you know, is wrong. And then there is the last thing, which is, I know it's more than three. And the last thing is, you know, they say, they come to you and say, hey, you know, AI is here for the future. It's here to stay. It's here for the future. And they tell you basically basic stuff. And I'm like, you know, no shit, Sherlock. You have to tell me things that I don't know. You know, when I see you, I have to be like, what do you know that I don't know? How can we make money of you? And that's also some of them make the mistakes of just saying general stuff. And I'm like, yeah, of course. I mean, I know this already. I hope you know it. What do you know that I don't know? And yeah, that's something, you know, some of the mistakes I could talk for hours because, as you said, I've been doing this for years and, you know, I've been studying them, but I would say the five most important ones.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing such valuable advice. I'm sure that all of our, you know, all of the people, especially founders who are listening to this, they're definitely going to take some notes because these advice were like very, very valuable. And obviously, us with Caesar, we could keep going. There are a lot of things we want to just tell you about, but unfortunately, we're running out of time. Caesar, just wanted to ask you one last question, not to take your time. Maybe could you please recommend a book that actually influenced your thinking, not only in terms of VC, but also as a human being? Maybe it could be a book about finance. Maybe it could be like a self-help book, maybe about sports or, I don't know, about anything.
Yeah, Only the Paranoid Survive. Maybe you know it. It's a book that was wrote by I forgot if it was like Andrew Grove or Gulf, but it was the former CEO of Intel. And the book was very interesting. I read it after Christmas, so like 8 months ago. And it was a very interesting book because basically it talks about the, and it's nowadays it's truer than ever with AI and blockchain. It talks about, you know, the strategic inflection points, and it talks about, you know, how to see if there is a strategic inflection point or not in the industry. And he basically says, look, if you see that your competitors are changing, so probably something is changing and you should like really study that change and get moving. If you see that your clients are changing as well, if you see that the needs of your client change, and then you should also ask a question to yourself, which is like, imagine you have a new technology such as ChatGPT. And you're like, if this technology, ChatGPT is just an example, if this technology had to 10x, would it be a strategic inflection point? Would it completely change your industry? If yes, then it's probably a strategic inflection point, and you should act on it. And the book was very, you know, it really taught me a lot because actually it's true now because of AI, but it was also true 10 years ago, and it was true 20 years ago and 30 years ago. It's like, and it's going to be true like in 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years. So even though the technology changed, in the book, he was talking actually about the new chips that were coming out. And he was talking about like how Intel was so big at his time, but actually how they were losing market share. And I mean, we also saw how it ended. So actually he was right. And when he wrote the book, actually Intel was very big. So he saw things, you know, by far and predicted everything. So this book is truer than ever, and it's always going to be to be up to date, because even though the technology describes are different, the theory is the same. You know, the strategic inflection point, you should study them as a business owner. And if you see a strategic inflection point, you have to decide, do I stay with what I have and really become a specialist when I have with the risk of being left behind? Or should I make the investment to build that technology with me? With the risk that I might be too ahead of time, or with the risk that, you know, someone has already done it, so I'm behind it anyways, and I lose the money on the investment.
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for sharing this book with us. I'm definitely going to, unfortunately, I did not read that book, but definitely going to download either an ebook or I'm going to order it through Amazon. Definitely going to have to read it.
For Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyways, Caesar, thank you so much for your time. This is very, very valuable for us. I'm
Thanks for
sure
having me.
they took a lot of notes. They are more aware about the VC industry, not only in the US, but also in Northern Europe. They got a lot of insights in terms of in terms of having mentor. They also learned a lot about your background. Maybe some of the lessons, life lessons that you shared would actually help them, change something in their lives. So definitely every podcast that we host, there's like a lot of life stories, a lot of insights that people learn. So this is another incredible story from you. So yeah, thanks so much again.
Thanks really for having me. It was a pleasure, and I'm actually looking forward to be coming back from every invite again.